You're listening to the podcast of Village Church in Burbank, California. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org. We hope you enjoy today's message.
This morning I was going to be leading a special smaller service for all of our couples that are over there right now. We have couples that are at their marriage retreat this weekend. But we had a change of plans. The speaker who I originally scheduled to take my place for this weekend had kind of a urgent work situation that he could not get out of, an obligation that just kind of created a conflict for him. So you're stuck with me again for this weekend. But if you need a break from me, it's coming up soon. I promise you that, just in a few weeks. But I am going to preach, and I'm going to preach the sermon that was on my heart to preach at the marriage retreat, but it's not really specifically about marriage. So I think it'll fit just fine in our context. And I'm actually really excited to preach this sermon this weekend. It's called When the Wine Runs Out. And it comes to us from a passage of Scripture that I think many of us here are very familiar with. I think even folks who have never opened a Bible or been in a church before, they've heard something about this story. They know something about it. It's the story of Jesus turning water to wine. So let's go ahead and look at it. John chapter 2. John chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Y'all ready? Yeah. All right, let's go. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." Amen. So I have, throughout my life, I've been involved in a lot of weddings in a variety of capacities. I've attended a lot of weddings. I've been the groom at a wedding. I've been a groomsman at several weddings. I've officiated many weddings. I've performed the music and sung at weddings. I know a lot about weddings, and one of the things that I know about weddings is that something always goes wrong. You plan, you prepare, you rehearse, you pray, you do everything you know how to do, but something will go wrong. Maybe it's the day of the wedding and it's raining, or people come, they arrive much later than they should, or the bride doesn't show up. Or there's tension between family members that everybody can sense. Something's going to go wrong. I'll tell you a quick story. Years ago, probably over a decade ago, somebody had contacted me. They wanted to hire me to sing at their wedding. I didn't know who they were, but they knew that I did music. And they wanted me to sing three songs. So they hired me to sing three songs. And there's a couple funny things that happened involving this venture. One of the songs they wanted me to sing was "Wind Beneath My Wings." Right? First of all, so that 80s, yes, that 80s song, "Wind Beneath My Wings." Y'all know that song, right? I'm not crazy. All right. So I'm like, okay, whatever. I'll sing "Wind Beneath My Wings." Never sung it before. We'll never sing it again. But about a week before the wedding, I was in my house. Nobody else was home. So I was like, this is a great time to rehearse. I don't like to rehearse when people are around. So I went into the corner room, one of the corner rooms of the house, and I had a CD track of the song "Wind Beneath My Wings" and put it in the CD player. If you're sitting with kids, explain that to them later. I pop it in, I press play. So I'm starting to go through Wind Beneath My Wings. And I get to like close to the end of the song around the bridge when Bette Midler, if you remember her recording of it, she just goes off. You know, she is belting it out. Did you ever know that you're my... And she's just going nuts on it. So I'm like, okay, nobody's around. Let me kind of play around with this. And, you know, I'm just going to go for it. So I'm kind of rehearsing that part over and over again, trying to work with different ideas, you know. It's just all out. And right in the middle of doing that, I look through the blinds and through the window, like 10 feet away from where I'm standing, the exterminator is spraying our house. And there's no chance that he did not hear me. And I'm like, oh, I'll never be able to look this guy in the eyes again. I'm going to have to change exterminating companies now. Well, anyway, the actual wedding comes the next week. And they had already told me during the rehearsal, okay, you're going to sing this song here, second song here, and then the last song here. Well, they wanted me to sing the third and final song after the pronouncement as the bridal party's walking out. And I was like, just in my own internal thoughts, I'm like, this is a terrible time for somebody to perform a song. But it wasn't my wedding. I don't know these people. They hired me. I'm just going to do what they want me to do. I'm not going to mess up their plans. So anyway, we get to that spot in the wedding, and the preacher makes the pronouncement, announced to you, Mr. and Mrs. whatever, and I don't even remember their names. And the bridal party starts walking out, which takes all of 15 seconds. Well, once the bridal party's gone, I'm starting the song. What do you think everybody does? They all stand up and leave. And so by the middle of the second verse, it's just me and the sound guy. I'm serenading the sound person. Like, think about, like, what if, like, after the service, it's just me and Jason Michaels. Did you ever know that you're my hero? It would be really awkward, like it is right now. So anyway, something at every wedding, whether it's something small like that or something big, something always doesn't go quite the way you envision it. Well, in our passage today, we're at a wedding, and at this wedding, there is a major crisis. This is not a minor snafu. This is a major deal, and I'm going to explain why in a moment. But this is a family crisis, a social crisis, an economic crisis, a cultural crisis. Like, if you're in this room and you are going through some kind of crisis right now, this passage is for you. So in John chapter 2, John, right off the bat, he lets us know that there's a wedding, and not only that, he tells us it's the third day. Now, if you've heard me preach on the Gospel of John, you ought to know by now that John is not just telling you something on the surface. The Gospel of John is like a magic eye poster. And yeah, he'll give you an illustration on the surface, but he wants you to look deeper because there's something underneath that he also wants you to see. So when John tells us that it's the third day of the wedding, he's really telling us two things at once. Yes, on the surface, he's telling us it is the third day of the wedding. One of the things you need to know about ancient Jewish weddings is that they lasted typically 7 days. You know, a town like Cana is a very tiny village. Not today, but back then it would have been a few dozen people, maybe 100 people or so. So this is a tiny village, and they're all intricately connected relationally, socially. Their families go back many generations, like maybe like hundreds of years. So they are very much involved and ingrained into one another's lives. And the occasion of a wedding in a town like that is a rare event. So they would go all out. People would absolutely stop their lives for 7 days and just celebrate and have a big feast. They don't often have this kind of event. So John's telling us it's the third day. We're about halfway through this 7-day wedding celebration. But everybody who's familiar with the story of Jesus as told in the Gospels, you know that the third day also speaks to the time when God moves. It speaks about new life. It speaks to resurrection power. Jesus rose from the dead on the third day. And so John wants us to know that even though this event is happening at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, there is a third day even on this day. And that any moment, any day of your life could be, can be, the moment when God breaks in and does something that you're not anticipating. So Jesus is at this wedding on the third day. scholars estimate maybe about 100 people are at this wedding. And he's there with his disciples. His mother Mary is there. And all of a sudden, on the third day of this wedding, a crisis hits. And the wine has run out. I don't know who was responsible. I don't know if there was a wedding planner, and the wedding planner just didn't follow through. Or maybe there was supposed to be a delivery, and the delivery was delayed and didn't get there in time. I don't know whose fault it was, but the wine runs out, and you have to understand the nature of the embarrassment and shame of this crisis. Another thing you need to know about ancient Jewish weddings is that the bride's family was considered responsible for feeding everyone. And this isn't a three-hour wedding reception. This is 7 days. This is a feast. This takes really years of thought, putting money aside and planning. And for the wine to run out halfway through the thing, this is intense shame and embarrassment in an honor-shame culture. This is a huge crisis, a huge social crisis. Like, imagine you're at a wedding, and right in the middle of the reception, the food runs out. Or right in the middle of the electric slide, the music runs out. Somebody trips over the cord. The shame that you feel, multiply that by 1,000. And that's what this family is experiencing. This is a problem. And this really serves for us as a metaphor for life, because wine in the Bible, wine is a picture of celebration. Wine is a symbol of joy. Wine is a symbol of abundance. But we all know that the reality of life is that from time to time, the wine runs out. There are times and seasons of intense joy and celebration, and then there are also times and seasons in our lives where the joy and the celebration run out. How many of you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And this is what we know, is that relationships that were once characterized as delightful, sometimes the wine runs out. Environments that were once marked by such celebration, sometimes the wine runs out. As we get older, the wine of our health runs out. The wine of feeling like we're in control runs out. Sometimes for people, the wine of success runs out. The wine of our strength runs out. Some of you are married right now, and it may feel like the wine of your marriage is running out. There used to be such joy in life and abundance. Or just personally, as an individual, you used to be a person of joy and contentment, and now it's been replaced by just some emptiness and despair. The wine's running out. I want to ask you this question. I want you to ponder this with me as we move forward. Where is the wine running out right now in your life? Where's the wine running out? Where is there a shortage? Where is there a problem? Where is there lack? Where is there disorientation? Where's the wine running out in your life? I want you to just name that right now and hold it before God. Well, in this moment, we see a good response from Mary, the mother of Jesus. Mary sees what's unfolded, that the wine has run out on the third day. There's still 4 days left and the wine's gone. And Mary empathizes with this family. She can feel their embarrassment. And she goes to Jesus and she says, "Son, look at this. The wine has run out." Now, I've often wondered, like, what is Mary really saying here? Like, I suppose it's possible, yes, maybe Mary is just like an external processor. So she sees what's happened. She feels the secondhand embarrassment. She really hurts for this family. And man, it's just overwhelming her. And she just has to get it out. She's like, "Oh, this is so awful. Look at this. The wine's run out." Maybe that's all she's doing. Maybe she's just externally processing. I don't know that. I kind of see maybe more likely that what she's really doing is she's telling Jesus to get to work without saying it. Like, "Son, the wine's run out. You know what to do." I don't know what kind of relationship Jesus had with his mother, but I do know the kind of relationship that I have with my wife, Carrie. And I know that when Carrie says something like, "Hey, Ryan, the trash can is full in the kitchen," she's not just externally processing in that moment. She's giving instructions. Because, you know, I'm the director of sanitation in my house. That's what I do. I take out the trash. Typically, and so when Carrie says something like, "Hey, Ryan, the trash can's full," I don't just say, "Oh, that's a problem," and keep doing what I'm doing. No, what she's really saying when she says that, I've learned to translate, is, brother, get to work. Take this trash bag out, put it in the garbage bin outside, and when you come back inside, put another bag in. Don't forget that part. So maybe that's what Mary's doing. She's just telling Jesus, get to work. Well, Jesus responds in verse 4 in a very curious way. He says, woman, what concern is that to me? Now, the trouble with the Bible sometimes is we can't read tone. We can't read volume. And so we sometimes kind of fill in the blanks just in our imagination. And so I think oftentimes we can see Jesus saying this maybe frustrating, in a frustrating tone. He's annoyed. Woman, what concern is that to me? But I also think it's possible and probable that he's really saying this in a more tender way. Like at the very end of John's gospel, when Jesus is on the cross and he says, woman, behold your son. Son, behold your mother, as Mary and John are standing there in front of him. And then Mary says these words. She doesn't say anything else to Jesus. She walks over to the servants of the wedding, and she says, do whatever he tells you. So it's a very simple sequence. She says to Jesus, son, they've run out of wine. He says, woman, what concern is that to me and to you? My time hasn't come. She doesn't say another word to him. She goes to the servants, do whatever he tells you. And those five words right there, by the way, that's the essence of the Christian life. Do whatever he tells you. What does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to follow Jesus? It means you do whatever he tells you. And so in verse 7, Jesus says to the servants, he tells them to fill 6 water jars with water, and they fill them. This is obedience. They fill these 6 jars. And then he said, now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. And at some point between the moment they're pouring the water into the jars to the moment they draw some out to give to the master of the feast, at some point this water has transformed into wine. And the wine is so good that the master of the banquet cannot believe it. And he says, you know, most folks at a wedding, they bring out the best wine first, the strong stuff first. And then later on, after people are pretty well inebriated, then they bring out the cheap stuff when nobody can tell the difference. You guys have saved the best for last. Now it says there, don't miss this detail. It says that these are 6 jars, which each of them hold 20 to 30 gallons. I've seen, by the way, replicas of these jars. They go up to my chest, and they're like this wide, and it's solid stone. So these are massive jars, and there's 6 of them. 20 to 30 gallons each. It's the equivalent of, if my math is correct, 120 to 180 gallons. So in other words, Jesus doesn't just make enough wine for everybody to have a sip. He makes the equivalent of 700 to 800 bottles of wine for a party of about 100 people. This is a picture of God's abundance. That's what I want you to see. God is not stingy. This is a picture of God's generosity, his outrageous, overwhelming generosity, showering us with mercy upon mercy, grace upon grace, forgiveness upon forgiveness. So as we ponder this story this morning, I just want to give you 3 things. I could give you a lot of things, but I'm going to be preaching on this passage again in a few months, so I got to save some material, all right? I want to give you 3 simple thoughts. In fact, I actually put something else on my website this week that wouldn't fit into my sermon, but I just felt like I wanted to give it out. But I want to give you 3 things. First of all, and this is a very simple thought, but it's so profound. This story can teach us that there is no situation that Jesus is not interested in helping us with. Jesus is interested in it all. And I love the fact that this is his first miracle. You know, if I were part of Jesus' strategic planning team, and we're talking about, okay, what should his first miracle be? I'm thinking of something much more on a grander scale. Let's do something in front of the whole world. Let's do something at the corner of the temple complex in front of thousands of people during Passover, millions of people. And let's do something really big, like raise somebody from the dead, something really consequential that's going to make a huge difference. Let's kick this thing off that way. And I think it really says something about Jesus and about the nature of his kingdom that his very first miracle occurs at a party for a group of people and ministers to a family that is just shriveled in shame. You know what, we often think that there are some situations that are way too small for God to care about. And I just want to tell you, there's no situation that's too small for God to care about. This is why we pray without ceasing for things that are big and things that are small. God is infinitely longing to participate and be involved in every aspect of your life. There's no area that Jesus is not interested in helping us with. But here's the second thing that I want to show you. And this is really strong in my heart for this weekend. Transformation requires our participation. So Mary tells the servants, do whatever he tells you. And Jesus says, fill these 6 stone jars with water. And this is not easy work. It would be for you and me. We just get the hose connected to the faucet in our backyard, turn it on. Just like that. No sweat. They didn't have that kind of plumbing technology. This involves finding the nearest well, taking a container they can carry, drawing water, carrying it to the jars, pouring it in, going back, drawing more water, carrying it probably 40, 50 times. I mean, these are 6 jars of 100 together, 120 to 180 gallons. I want you to get a visual of that. This is work. It's slow work. It's tedious work, ordinary work, tiresome work. But after doing all of the hard, ordinary, tiresome work, it says that each one of those jars was filled to the brim. And at that moment, in other words, once these servants had put in the slow, ordinary, tedious, tiresome work, at that moment, the water is transformed into wine. You know, many of us, we want the new wine of transformation, just like that, just out of nowhere. And certainly God moves in great power and transforms us, but I think more often than not, Jesus invites us to participate in our own transformation. And that transformation, that effort we put into it is often slow, it's ordinary, and it can be tiresome. So let me just make it very plain for you. For some of you in marriage, maybe the wine has run out, and what we want is an overnight FedEx miracle of transformation. And Jesus' word may be, well, yeah, but before I turn this water into wine, you need to fill the pot. And filling the pot often means slow, tiresome work and effort. It may mean that you go together to counseling, couples counseling, 5, 6, 7 times. Are you filling the pot? Some of you, maybe there are addictive behaviors in your life and you're wondering, why doesn't Jesus just heal me just like that? And it's because Jesus often wants us to participate in our own transformation. So he says, yes, but first, I want you to go to that support group on Thursday nights and learn to confess it to someone honestly and be real about what you're going through. And every time you do that, you're pouring more water into the pot. Maybe you feel spiritually dry and you're like, Jesus, why don't you just zap me right now and fill me with your life? And certainly Jesus can do that. But I think most of the time, in my experience, what Jesus says is, you know what, why don't you spend some time reflecting in prayer with me this week? Why don't you sit in silence with me for 15 minutes this afternoon and just start incorporating that rhythm into your life? And every time we sit with Jesus, every time we come to the Lord in reflective prayer in the scriptures, every time we attend 9 o'clock service, and every time we partake in communion or attend our small group, we're putting a little bit more water into the pot. And we're positioning ourselves to one day see that water transformed into wine. Is that making sense? Transformation requires our own participation. And when the wine runs out, It's an opportunity. Last thing. This story is a sign, we're told. John, I told you last week that John, the Gospel of John, is structured around seven signs, seven miracles. But he doesn't call them miracles. He calls them signs. And what is a sign? A sign is something that points you somewhere. It's pointing you to a certain reality. If I see, if I'm taking my kids to Disneyland, and I see a sign on the side of the road that says Disneyland and it's giving me an arrow, I don't get all excited about the sign and take pictures with the sign. No, I'm getting excited about what the sign's pointing me to. And this is the very first sign in the Gospel of John. What is it pointing us to? And I want you to see that the point of this story is not just simply that Jesus knows how to keep a party going, or that he knows how to do like really cool out-of-the-box miracles. The point of this story is to point us to another reality, that there comes a day 3 years after this wedding when Jesus stretches out his arms and dies on a cross. And on that day, everyone around him, all of his friends, his disciples, all of these folks who had believed in him and trusted in him and hoped for him, it felt to them like the wine had run out. But on the third day, on the real third day, the third day that the world was really longing for and didn't know it, Jesus is resurrected in power and the wine starts flowing again. The wine of his salvation flows again. The wine of his healing begins to flow again. The wine of his power begins to flow again. And his wine just keeps flowing and flowing and flowing. And this is what Jesus says. All it takes is a sip. Just a sip of Jesus' wine can transform your life. Isn't that what the scriptures say? Taste and see that the Lord is good. Just a sip of Jesus' wine can satisfy. And the reality of our lives is this, that sometimes the wine runs out and we end up turning around and we start drinking the wrong wine. We start drinking somebody else's Kool-Aid. You know, I spent years drinking the Kool-Aid of religion, unhealthy religion. I believe in religion, but unhealthy, toxic religion. Boy, that'll make you sick to your stomach. That's bitter to the taste. The wine runs out, and we think, I got to go find it somewhere else. I got to find something to satisfy the longing of my soul. But there's only one wine. I've lived this. There's only one wine and wine giver that can satisfy the longings of your soul. How many of you can testify today, more money will not satisfy the longing of your soul? Another degree will not satisfy the deepest longings of your soul. Another job, another house, another car will not satisfy. Another sexual experience will not satisfy the longing of your soul. Another relationship will not satisfy. But just a sip of Jesus' wine, man, that'll satisfy the deepest cravings of a person's life.
Thank you for listening to today's message. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org.